Shiva and Mana. Yeah, that was intense. They're fun. The plane.
Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
have the same problems this morning.
I think there, let me tell you why, though, that there's something on my mind that I do want to spend time talking with you about, but I feel like it's just not the right time. It's something I'd rather talk about at the end of the course, not at the beginning of the course. But I'm just going to tell you briefly, so maybe that'll clear out the kind of inner push for that as something that needs to be talked about. And it's because of... when at the end of the Tattva Buddha, when we were talking about all of the punya goes to the good students, so to speak, those who have Shraddha and all of that, and the papa goes to the students who are very negative or hateful or whatever toward the teacher. And then after I said that at the end, then I started talking about, you know, that relationship, that having that Shraddha for your teacher, and kind of almost, you almost circumscribe that relationship to keep it within just that guru sisha box, you know, and keep yourself free of gossip or letting people talk negatively about the teacher. And remember, I gave that talk. But then somebody brought up to me, and I'd also already had kind of this, what do you call it? Kind of really meaning exactly what I was talking about. And at the same time, within the teacher-student relationship, as well as within the therapeutic relationship too, there's a certain charlatanism and abuse that's gone on in terms of teachers almost using that as a tool to keep the students from getting the inappropriate behavior of the teacher, and getting the teacher in trouble, so to speak, or using it in such a way as to make excuses for a behavior that is really not good and problematic. And so then I thought, well, I'd said this, but in saying it, I was living in this very pure, in this very pure kind of archetypal space without the kind of how it's supposed to be space, without talking about or even thinking about really the shadow side of what most of us are familiar with, which has to do with abuse or charlatanism, you know, or sexual abuse, especially in the therapeutic relationship, in relationships where there's any kind of power differential. So it's there in the guru-sishya relationship, it's there in the, especially in the therapeutic relationship, it's there in the forbidden territories, you find it there, you know. And now, just a little aside on the therapeutic relationship, it's say in Jung's time, or say in the 1940s, 30s, 40s, 50s, there was very little studies or consciousness around this. And so if therapists were having sexual relationships with their patients, there was no guards against it. There was no knowledge out there about that, why that would be wrong. There's no consequences to that type of behavior, whereas now there really is. In fact, you lose your license, you lose your reputation. It's a very strict, and therapists are also taught, as they're in training, they're taught very thoroughly about the transference and why it's problematic, why not to do it, even when you, even when, say, after 3 years, even if you, 3 years, then it's not illegal, but then it's advised against, because once a therapist, always a therapist. Because there's a power differential that takes place in the psyche. You know, it's just like with your mother and father, when you move out of the house and you become a mother and father yourself, you know, and you have your own job and you have your own income, you're still never on an equal level with your parents. You know, your parents are your parents, and that it doesn't really matter. You can be 60 and your parents are 80, and they're still your parents. You know, and that transference never goes away. And it's not really possible. You don't just become best friends with your parents. You can be best friends with your mother. You know, not best friends where the mother is not there or the father is not there. So anyway, this type of relationship, such a close, intimate relationship, the therapeutic relationship, is also very, very deep, very close. You know, and a lot happens in that little container. So, in fact, it's very much advised in that therapeutic relationship there be no touching of any kind. No handshake, no when they come in, no hugging. It's all a relationship that is taking place in the mind, in the imagination, in the buddhi. It's a very shared intimacy, but there's no physical acting out of any kind. Nor is there any role changing. I'm just saying this because I want you to, because this bleeds over into the therapeutic relationship, and it bleeds over also even to the teacher-student relationship at a university. Especially, I mean, at a high school or grammar school, obviously, but even at a university where there are adults, you know, so two people can kind of make their own decisions. We say no, because there's a power differential there. And even say in a, I'll get back to the therapy in a minute, but even though they're the same age and they're over 18 and all of this kind of stuff, still, even we find from studies and just from experience that say even a teacher marries one of their students, you know, and they're certainly of age and you should think there's no problem, but there is a problem. And the problem is that power differential is never overcome. The teacher is always one up in the sense that transference is always there. They're the one who knows. And the student is stuck in kind of a student-teacher relationship. Now, sometimes that can, even when they're married and they're having children and they're supposed to be, you know, everything's fine, it isn't fine. Psychologically, they find it's not fine. It's not equal. It's not two equals coming together, right? So, of course, in the therapeutic relationship, there's so much trust and so much deep sharing, and also there's so much love also in that relationship, and so much like dependence, and the client will often, this is therapeutic, the client will often really fall in love with the therapist. Deeply. It's not that the love isn't real. Love is love, you know. But so you can't say that they're not in love. They are in love. They've fallen in love. But really, that love is based upon a transferential relationship that's happening within this container that has so much projection and so much things are working out, being worked out. And in fact, the therapist is trained to allow all of those projections to happen and to be with them and to never act them out. It's not about not being able to, it's about being able to hold those feelings and to be with them in a way that is helpful and healing and be able to process them so that the patient or the client can take back those feelings as your own love, as your own strength, you know. But what happens unless the therapist is well trained, which now they are, and then if they're abusing, they're abusing. But it's not that they don't know. No. they know very well now. And so what they have to be able to do is to be able to receive that love, to receive it, but to understand it and to not then themselves fall in love, you know, with the client. And sometimes a person or a therapist fails at being able to do that. and then all kinds of, at least in the therapeutic world, all kinds of problems, legal problems develop. But also, a lot of times, you know, love is so real, the emotion of love, which is a problem. It's not that the emotion of love or being in love is not there. It is there. And it is very, very compelling and hard not to act it out unless you have a real knowledge base and you understand what really happens to the client if you were to act that out. One author, I forget his name right now, but anyway, he many years ago, he wrote a Union article on this. You know what he called it? This very type of abuse, what we call abuse, rape of the soul. It's a rape of the soul because the transference is so much, the love is so much, you know, that you can't ever, it's not the responsibility at all of the student or of the client, you know, or the one who's on the weaker side of the power differential. It's not their responsibility to say, oh no, we shouldn't really be doing that. It's not their responsibility. They have come to you to be able to handle the transference and do what is necessary, you know, to handle them in a healing way, certainly not to act out. So that acting out whenever there's a power differential is not, and that includes like a priest and parishioner, lawyer and client, teacher, student, you know. And of course, Guru Sisha, but like if you say priest and parishioner and Guru Sisha, this applies everywhere. And unfortunately, in academics, there are many, especially it's a harder problem for whatever reason. Well, there are obvious reasons, but that's not the point right now. Why it's mostly men that get in this problem. And we even had one faculty member who just couldn't leave the women alone. He actually destroyed a couple of women, I think. You know, destroyed their life at the school because, of course, they get involved in this relationship and then he's not interested anymore. You know, and just makes mincemeat out of the person and they can't. He's a faculty member and how can they manage with that, with all of those deep feelings and then being so hurt? How are they going to manage all of that, you know? And one of the excuses that this particular professor used was, well, this is my community. I have to date somebody. You're serious? You know, who am I going to go out with? Because these are the people that, you know, make our... And we do have a very close community. So, so awful. Anyway. We finally got him under control. Not easy to do, but in the meantime, a couple of people were very seriously hurt. So these things, the Guru-Sisha relationship is very difficult in this regard because there's so much love. There's just so much love. It touches your heart in the deepest area that you can possibly be touched. And so the Sishas, the students, are often love their teacher beyond any kind of love that they have ever felt. And the devotion and the Shraddha and the care is so much there. Okay. And then these gurus, teachers, I just call them teachers. Especially even whether Indian or Western, it doesn't really matter. None of them have been trained like psychologists are now trained. They still, to this day, don't really understand. And so if they have dalliances or they get involved in this way and this way, they don't understand the psychology of the whole thing, you know. And so there's a lot of abuse and a lot of damage that is now not that unusual. You know, before I go on with this, I want to tell one really interesting and wonderful thing about the kind of the Indian culture of old that is not so much operational now. But when I first came into India in 1972, it was still pretty much in place, much to the Westerners' chagrin. I mean, we weren't so happy that this was in place. But the teacher-student relationship in India, the guru-sisha relationship, used to be very, very formal. You know, you would never... There's just so many protocols in terms of the way you treated the teacher. There was a tremendous amount of just respectful protocols. You would never, like, go in to the teacher's room, especially a woman, go into their kutir. That was totally out of the question. And Swamiji made a compromise. This was in the 70s. After this all went away after some time, especially coming to the West and all that. We have no idea about any of that. But I'm talking about in India, the boundaries between the teacher-student relationship were so very protective that you didn't have to worry about dual relationships. Even to think that your guru is your friend, he's not your friend, or she's not your friend, she's your guru. He's your guru, you know? And this type of getting yourself into trouble because, especially in India, where the men and women don't even look at each other, they in the 70s. In fact, one little funny story is when I was there in 1972, so that first year, I was just a Westerner, and I was walking along, and I would just, anybody who came by, you know, just hi and whatever, look them right in the eye. Perfect for a charlatan. Not even for, what do you call them? It meant, I'm ready for you. I'm coming on to you. Yeah, that's what it means. I had no idea. They don't look each other in the eye at all. And so Swamiji called me in privately. And he just explained it to me. He explained it so gently. And I just remember kind of turning red and feeling so embarrassed. But it's because I was just, to me, I was just being a normal person. You know, you walk by and acknowledge people and whatnot. But if you look them in the eye, that's really a come on. You know, and he said, this is, don't look anybody in the eye. Don't look at them. Because if he said, if you look at them, they'll think that, you know, you are ready to have some sort of relationship with them. They explained all of this to me, and I said, I won't look at anybody. You know, and then I'd walk around and not look at anybody, very intentionally not look at people. But I'm talking now, I mean, that's the culture, because in India, at least in my era, this is still back in the 70s, which is quite a while, a lot of things have changed, become very westernized and whatnot. I mean, just among men and women, boys and girls, it's much different now, but it used to be, you really had no contact, you didn't talk to each other, only minimally, you didn't really look at each other in the eye. Let alone date. You didn't date at all. Your first real contact with a woman of any type of intimacy, and by intimacy, I mean being able to look at them in the eye, and, you know, you're sitting there with your parents, you know, at the girl's house, you know, the parents, so here they are, you know, and the kids are sitting there, you know, in one across the room from each other, and they're just looking at each other, and I guess they're just really, honestly, they're just seeing whether that person's demeanor and way of being, how they look and everything, is there an attraction there? Do you have any interest? You know? Because now that they've brought the two together, they already know that the charts all match, and the, you know, they're from the kind of the same socioeconomic status and all of that. So it should work. It should work if that attraction is there. And so both of them privately have to tell to their parents, yeah, I think. Anyway, so what I'm saying is even in the culture, it was very, very strict, you know. And when Swamiji gave the first course in 1972, no women were allowed. We just got in because of Swami Chinmayananda accepting one of his Western students in Hawaii. And the Swami Chinmayananda was Swamiji's teacher, you know. And so he had to let that girl in, and so then he let all of the group of Western women, which is about six people, he let them in, and no Indian women. I think it was like that went on for about 10 years, no Indian women. Doesn't sound very fair, you know? But the problem was not at all that they are nothing wrong with them being women. It is that dynamic, that chemistry, you know, that charge that is there, that the boys won't be able to handle it, and there's going to be a mess. And he didn't want to deal with that, you know. Because of the intensity of that, you know, of sexuality, you know. Especially in young people. So he was very aware of that. The culture was very aware of it. There were so many protections put up around the protocols of the Guru-Sisha relationship, you know, so that the sanctity and that sahanabhavatu, you know, let there be no enmity, no problems between us. The relationship was kept very, very formal in order to protect that Guru-Sisha relationship, so that your guru can remain your guru and there's no confusion there, you know. And so, and of course in India, you know, the boundaries are very strict, and if everybody's watching everybody else continually, that's part of Indian culture, you know, watching everybody else, talking about what everybody else is doing, and everybody knows that everybody's doing that, you know. And so if you do anything, you know, you look the wrong way at somebody, somebody knows that. It's talked about. Because that's just, you know, they didn't have, when I was there was really no TV and hardly any movie theaters. So it was all just, you know, social communication, talking about every which thing. And so the culture itself keeps a strong order, sense of order, based upon everybody's interest in everybody else and noticing if anything's going awry and talking about it, you know. But also, that's just an aside with the people, but that Guru-Sisha relationship was so handled, with so much reverence and so much respect, you know. And so, say if I am talking like I was talking, I'm really talking from this archetypal position of purity and not thinking about, you know, all of the stories of abuse and problems that are out there that we all know about. Well, I talked about this one person, we were in satsang one time, I talked about this one person who was a Western guru who caused so many problems, and then one of you said, yeah, but then there's this guy also. And we kind of compared them, and they were kind of very similar, actually, and they got in the same kind of thing. So now to tell the story a little differently, where what I say is what I was talking about, that kind of purity and being able to let the thing, the gossipy things and all of that kind of things, or if somebody's talking negatively about your teacher, you know, because he hurt their feelings or this and that went wrong. But that teacher, the teacher themselves are within Dharma. There's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong. You know, and there's nothing about that teacher that is going against Dharma and causing suffering to yourself and others. You know, that's important. So taking that, and I guess I was thinking in our Sampradaya, you know, the people that we have and are working with, I don't feel that threat, you know, but it's everywhere, so it's in our thing too. Our thing is pretty big now. And so we have to say no to anything that kind of goes outside of what the Guru-Sisha relationship is supposed to be. And so that usually happens when the teacher's a man, actually. It can happen when the teacher's a woman also, but it's usually a man. And so what we have to do in that case is if, you know, because men can get carried away with themselves and with their sexual attraction, and these kind of things people can make mistakes. But for your own sake as a woman, or if this happens to you as a man with a woman teacher, you have to say no. Don't let that happen. Because it will not work out. Even if you try to get involved with, if a woman tries to get involved with a brahmachari, it won't work out. Chances are like a million to one, that it won't work out. Maybe that's a little high, but a brahmachari, say for those of you who have been in India, even if the person's a brahmachari, they haven't taken sannyasa yet, but they still are young men, young virile men, and they want to experiment, they want to have a relationship. Or the person is a guru and they're virile, young, virile men, and they haven't had very much experience. They want that experience, you know. And you're in love with them because they're so wonderful and they're so kind and they're so beautiful, so your heart is open and all that love is there. It's hard to say no unless you're trained, you know. You're trained to say no, and you understand what is happening, how much advantage you're taking of that woman and of that love. You're absolutely taking advantage of that person when you have no intention, really, of, or no ability even to, or want or desire to stop being a sannyasi or stop being a brahmachari and have a relationship and get married. One thing in India, they don't have any way to do that. So they leave their brahmacharya, you know, or their sannyasa, then what are they going to do? How are they going to make a living? And at the same time, so many of them long for some sort of intimacy or some sort of relationship, and somebody seems to really love them, and so they want that desperately because it's so human. So we have to even think about this whole celibacy thing, unless as a man or a woman you're older and you've been through a lot of life, you know, already, and you've had your relationships, or you've been married and you've had your children, or you're old enough to have gone through relationships and you've been through kind of all of that sexuality and attraction and all of that, you know, and you're ready to take sannyasa, or you're ready to take brahmacharya, then you have a chance of handling these urges, you know. But say you haven't had that chance, never, that you go straight into brahmacharya and sannyasa without ever being allowed to have any type of sexual relationship, you know. Then there's very, very tough to control, and the need for that intimacy is so, so much there. But you're acting out that need on someone who is devoted to you and loves you in a totally different way, you know, and will do basically anything you say. And so there's a tremendous rape of the soul, there is a tremendous abuse. So we have to kind of know the rules in this era. We have to understand these rules. Both men and women have to understand transference, which I'll be talking in time more about transference and all that. We have to understand what actually happens in that, when there's that power differential and where there's a lot of love there, you know. If the teacher knows what's going on, which most of them don't, if they do know, then they know the damage that it does, they know the nature of the transference, that projection of the deepest love that you have, you know, and they know to hold that with sanctity, to respect it and to hold it, to not push it away, because that's also very horrible. To kind of abuse that love by pushing it away, but it's also very horrible to act it out, because it's hard for a woman to recover from that. Say you act it out, then that relationship is totally penetrated. So how to become okay after that? People don't, and this is true also with a therapist. How for those people to reconstitute themselves, who don't realize the psychological implications of all of this. And so, I mean, I think that the Indians and the Indian teachers and brahmacharis, they're kind of starting to understand a little bit. Even the Swamiji, he asked me to give a talk, and when I used to go to India every year. So one year, were you there, that talk? Okay.
I was there.
You were there? Oh my God. He asked me to give a talk about these kind of things, which he just can't talk about. It's too intimate, talking about sex and these kind of things. But there were a couple of issues that he wanted me to talk about, and one had to do with this, you know, the boundaries between a teacher-student relationship, because all of these young people were going out as teachers and they had no education around this at all. And some of them, not the Indians, because they won't talk one way or the other, they'll just hear it and keep quiet. You know, but some of the, a few of the, our Brazilian friends that were there, kind of hot-blooded, wonderful guys, they were kind of perturbed because a couple told me also. But, you know, these are our students that, you know, it was the same as that one professor who was from Spain, another very hot-blooded guy. Anyway, they're great guys, but they didn't have not heard this before, which is often the case. If there can be any kind of maybe some boundaries there, you know, that there should be some boundaries there to protect the relationship. So this is kind of new territory, you know. And so we have to know about this territory. Both men and women have to understand, maybe do some reading on it. I can also talk about it so that you're educated, you know, and you know kind of what the proper behavior is in terms of the teacher-student relationship, and you understand about the transference also. Who's heard the term transference before? Not too much, a little bit, yeah. We'll have to have a class just on the transference to really understand the power of it, you know. But if that's not understood, then you don't see the problem, you know. And the deep, fantastically deep love, the in-loveness and all that you feel is not a love between equals who have fallen in love with each other. It's a love that takes place within the transference. And the only way really for it to, the transference just goes on lasting in a funny way, or the one of the two, usually the psychologist or the, pulls out of the whole thing, and then the woman is left totally devastated. And that happens in the spiritual relationship also, in the guru-sishya relationship also. And then what happens is when you're teaching and holding the most sacred knowledge that there is, the moksha itself, and then you, out of your ignorance or whatever, you destroy a person, and you destroy their spirituality also. That actually happens. And Swamiji knows. And so he wanted me to teach about it also, you know, at the courses. Because I'm a psychologist and I can talk in depth about it, and I'm a Westerner, so I can say things that an Indian cannot say. But it's important to understand it, how powerful these things are. You know, so. And I felt after I'd given that talk, and then I remembered, and somebody had brought it up to me also, then I couldn't get it out of my mind. And then I would be sitting here, and that would keep coming. And, you know, I don't want to talk about that right now. Keep coming. All right, I don't have anything to say then. There, so we kind of got it. Yeah. These things are Another thing he wanted me to talk about also, in India, I'll just mention this, we can talk about it later, but because we don't have much time now, but since it was part of the same whole thing, you know, in India, though there are a lot of, you know, gay students of all different types, LGBTQ, all different types of gay students, gay young people, gay adults, but it is totally closeted. It is not talked about. People just, even if they are gay, and even if they, you know, they and another young boy, or mostly boys that I know of, but I'm sure there's girls also that are gay, they will fool around together, but they will never say that they're gay, never. It's absolutely forbidden. And then if one boy gets kind of involved and titillated and really has real feelings, you know, then often they will be so hurt and so ashamed that they'll actually strike out at the person who had gotten involved with them, you know, somebody who did this to them, this type of thing, because they can't handle it, because it is so taboo, it is so secret, it is so untouched. And so what can happen then, that there's the, you know, the 10% of the population, like 10% of the world, of all beings, not just humans, 10% of animals, 10% of all beings, you know, are gay. But they're not allowed to be. They're not allowed to live, really. They have to live in this totally closeted, fearful environment, and afraid of being ostracized and shamed, you know. And that kind of stuff is going to be happening anywhere. And at the ashram, of course, there was, you know, several young Indians and a couple of Westerners who were gay. And so there were some real abuse that took place around some of these kids, you know, and with no consciousness at all, because taboo, you know. And so I talked about that too in this talk. And so I had these two things. This one was a real taboo. And so actually a lot of the older people did not appreciate that I talked about that at all. In fact, I was walking back to my kutir with some students and friends, and way up in the front, walking way ahead of me, this gay couple, I mean, not gay couple, this elder couple, they said, they're walking, and they said to each other, she's gonna change the whole Indian culture. Yeah. So there's traditions, you know, there's traditions, and things are hush-hush, you know, they're just hush-hush. And I think the West is a little bit ahead in terms of understanding, having more understanding of psychology and more understanding of the reality of the world and the reality of human beings and the human spectrum, the sexual spectrum of human beings. And unless we have somebody like, you know, one who must not be named, you know, unless somebody like that. That in India, we have to catch up on these things. And it's our, as say for us, ourselves as teachers, you know, these things you have to know. All of these things, you have to study it. You have to have some understanding of psychology. You have to have understanding of the transference, so that you yourself don't get sucked into it, but you can hold it. You know, there's positive transference and negative transference too. As teachers, as students, we should understand it too, just to protect ourselves. But as students, you need to really understand it so you can protect your students from yourself, you know, from your own urges and things, because you have no understanding. You just take it all for real, and it isn't. It's very, very damaging. So these things are, you know, because I say this is a teacher training course, I think I've said enough about it now so that you know it's coming you know, in the last month or so, I'll talk some more in depth about these things, that these things that are responsibilities, you know, because as we hold this knowledge and we share this knowledge, you have responsibilities. And the responsibilities that we have require education. And then that education makes the responsibility kind of obvious. You know, it's not like somebody gives you a mandate and you have no idea why that mandate is there. You have no understanding of it, and so you don't really care. You know, if somebody's going to get mad at you because you do it, then you can just do it quietly because you have no clue about what it really means. So whenever I even feel like, if you're a teacher or a priest, you know, or a doctor, or any of the helping professions, let alone wherever there's a differential, these things have to be understood, and the tremendous vulnerability of your patients or of your students. It's a tremendous vulnerability. It's not an equal relationship. You know? And so that has to be, you have to understand the ins and outs of that so that you can protect them from that transference. And what we call counter-transference, where you can both get involved in something that's actually really damaging for both people. And also to be someone who sticks up for the people who are scapegoated for no reason. You know, the people that are scapegoated, like the gay population in the States. I don't know much about it in Europe, but in the States, depending on, you have a lot of white supremacists down in the States. I think all over Europe there's a lot of white supremacists. There's a whole list of people that are being scapegoated by that type of a mentality, you know. And that is very, very hurtful to the people and frightening for the people who are scapegoated, you know. Anybody of any color other than white becomes in the white supremacist movement, the alt-right, which I know is rising up all over the world. There's a lot of people who are scapegoated, you know. And we can never... we have to be a voice for those people also. That's why Swamiji wanted me to give the talk, because he knew that he could not be a voice yet in India for some of these things. So he wanted me to be a voice for him, because it would not be received well. You know, they're already saying about Swamiji for the last 20 years, he's becoming too Western. He's becoming a Westerner. And at the same time, he said plenty of things that he felt this would be, these couple of things would be more accepted by a Westerner than by an Indian singer. Yeah. Om Tat Sat. I will go into some more psychology a little later on in the course. Good things, psychological things to understand, but it'll be just gradually. We'll build up and put that. Okay.
Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harih Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harih Om.